God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble with its tumult. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
It is not without regret that I address you, the class of 1963, this morning. Our years together as a class at BCC were truly memorable ones. On September 5th, 1960, a morning similar to this one, we students first enrolled at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School as sophomores. Now, 1,017 days later, we are ready to graduate as seniors. We have come a long way in the relatively short span of 1,017 days. We've begun the transformation of our identities from adolescent teenagers to mature young men and women. And this transformation has been due almost entirely to our high school education at BCC. During that time, we received our first tastes of the adult world. We learned of the importance of cooperation with our fellow man, whether it was on the gridiron or in the classroom. We were granted independence and learned the proper manner of handling it. But most importantly, we became acquainted with responsibility to our school, to our classmates, and above all, to ourselves. We discovered that all these factors were expected from mature young people. And with the aid of our teachers, we were granted the opportunities to attain these goals, as well as the care and attention to see that we reached them. Now, as graduating seniors, we know we have arrived at the highest plateau to which our high school education can carry us. The days ahead seem formidable, but we can proceed securely with the knowledge that we have been well prepared at BCC for a successful future.
Ever since the infancy of this nation, agriculture has been our most important industry. Most of us gathered here this morning probably are not familiar with agriculture as an industry, but this is certainly not true of our speaker. The current Secretary of Agriculture is the youngest man ever to occupy his present position, and is the first man from Minnesota to be so honored. He possesses both of the basic requirements for the post: a thorough understanding of this country's agricultural problems, and a sound legal background. After spending his boyhood on his family's farm in Zumbrota, Minnesota, he worked his way through the University of Minnesota, where he received his AB degree, magna cum laude, in 1940. He is a member of Phi Beta Kappa. Following graduation, he entered the university law school. His legal training, however, was interrupted by World War II. From 1941 to 1945, he served as a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps, advancing to the rank of major. While leading a combat patrol in Bougainville Island in the South Pacific, he was severely injured by a Japanese sniper bullet. At the conclusion of the war, he returned to the university, where he received his law degree in 1946. While completing his legal education, he began to ascend the ladder of politics by becoming the assistant to the mayor of Minneapolis, Hubert H. Humphrey. From 1946 to 1949, he also served as the chairman of the Minneapolis Civil Service Commission. After building a successful law practice, he managed Mr. Humphrey's successful campaign in 1948 for the United States Senate, and was himself a successful candidate in 1954 for governor. He was reelected in 1956 and in 1958. In 1960, President Kennedy appointed him to be his Secretary of Agriculture, which is the post he now occupies. It is with great pleasure and deep respect that I present the Secretary of Agriculture, Orville L. Freeman. Secretary Freeman.
Thank you very much, Stephen Shulman, Class President Ben Hole, officers and members of this graduating class of 1963, their parents, relatives, and friends, Mr. Williams, and members of the faculty, ladies and gentlemen. The other day, I noted in the newspaper a rather interesting comment by a graduating senior, not of BCC, I hasten to add, that went something like this in describing his educational experience to this point. He said, "I've had the misfortune to be in grade school when the object was to make every pupil happy, and to be in high school when the object was to make every pupil smarter than the Russians." I think there's some truth in that evaluation, for the pace and the intensity of education, as I'm sure the very competent member of the school board, Mrs. Kecker, who joins us here this morning, would verify, has accelerated. And so I think it would be only appropriate and proper for a commencement speaker to express, first off, his sincere congratulations to the graduating seniors in this class of 1963 for having completed this rung in your educational career and successfully finished your studies here at BCC. You have worked hard. At least those of you with whom I've talked say you've worked hard, and I believe that you have. And you have graduated from a school that is highly respected, and I would predict in the years ahead you will value the educational experience you have had here perhaps more than you do at this moment. If you'll pardon me a personal reference, I would like to express my appreciation to the executive committee of this class for inviting me to be your commencement speaker. It has been my happy privilege on a number of occasions to be a commencement speaker, but never before in a class in which my daughter is one of the graduating seniors. And so as such, this is one of life's very, very special experiences for me, and I express my appreciation to you for the opportunity. As such, I would like very much to say something worthwhile. And so I thought about what I might say to you a good deal over the past several weeks since you extended this invitation. Among other things, I thought back to what was said and what I might remember when I had four graduating experiences myself. From grade school, because that was in the days of the eighth grade graduation, from high school, undergraduate and college, and from law school. And I discovered to my great dismay that not only could I not remember anything that was said at any four occasions, but I couldn't even remember who said it. So I would make one particular request that you at least remember that my name's Orville Freeman, that I'm Secretary of Agriculture, that I spoke at your commencement. I'll go on from there to assure you that I have a piece of Arab philosophy in mind that goes something like this. It says that wisdom is composed of 10 parts. 9 parts are silence and 1 part is brevity. And I'll seek to be guided accordingly. Might I set out here 2 pegs, 2 handles, if you will, to which I would address my brief remarks. On the first, I would borrow a little bit of teenage slangology, going back even to the time when I was a teenager, that you've heard and used. You've heard the expression, live it up. And you've also heard and used the expression, have a ball. Well, the second is a little newer than the first. I would direct some remarks to these phrases, expressions, live it up, have a ball, and also to another good rule of living, which is pay your bills. Pay your bills. First of all, when I say live it up, have a ball, I don't mean only in the sense of eat, drink, and be merry, as the Epicurean philosophers used that phrase and sought to enjoy life. That's a part of living, surely. I would use it more in the sense of your own personal attitudes as you approach the challenging days that lie before you. And I would urge that you approach them with real excitement, with real verve, with optimism, that you look at the opportunities that you have before you eagerly, and that you experience each of them with zest and with excitement. Be an optimist. Don't be a grouchy old pessimist. Look ahead. Don't look back. This very dimension of seeking for the positive, of feeling a sense of excitement, of bringing verve and zest to what you do, can make the difference between success and failure, and certainly between personal happiness and the opposite. And I think we can well do that in this new world of ours, because truly this is a wonderful, exciting time to be alive. This world about us is a rapidly moving, changing, dynamic place. There's nothing dead or decadent about it. It's on the move constantly. At this very moment, somewhere out in space, a man and a woman are robining around the globe. At this moment, in hundreds of laboratories around the world, scientists are probing the minuteness of the heart of the atom to see what it's made of, to see how it's arranged. Both of these are brand new worlds, and they open great new exciting possibilities from the infiniteness of the heart of that atom to the incomprehensible vastness of space itself. And the pace goes on faster and faster. No one knows exactly what will come of all this. But isn't it an exciting prospect? I heard the expression or description of the speed of change described something like this. There's some 50,000 years of recorded time, as the scientists can measure it, going back through the artifacts, the geologists. Suppose we compressed that 50,000 years into 50 years and measured it by what's happened. Well, in the first place, it would be only 10 years ago that man first came out of the caves, began to build crude shelters, and put on some clothes. It'd be 5 years ago that he began to write and to read a bit, only 5 years ago. 2 years ago, Christianity begun. 2 years ago. 2 months ago, the steam engine meant power and the advent of the Industrial Revolution. 2 weeks ago, just 2 weeks ago, electricity and the automobile. And less than a week ago, the atom bomb, the advent of atomic energy, burst on the horizon of this world. And so the pace is a constantly accelerating one. Now there are those that say that these are perilous times, who view them with pessimism and deep concern, whose eyes are clouded with concern and not bright with promise. Of course, there's danger, but the traveling companion of opportunity is always danger. To be sure, the power that can light 10,000 homes can blow them up. Certainly, the techniques of organization, such as automation, which make it possible for fewer and fewer people to do less work in the nature of drudgery, rather than making more time available to us for a higher quality of living, can mean unemployment, economic depression, and all that go with it. But that need not be so. And in the main, it has not been so. And when someone says to you, the good old days, well, they weren't good days for very many people. And increasingly, there are more good days for more people if we measure that phrase in terms of the opportunity to enjoy a higher quality of living, of getting away from the need of the deadening hand of drudgery, of hard, cruel, physical, depressing kind of work, the monotony that grinds us into something like an automaton. And so good things have come. Good things can and will come. And it's exciting, promising, dynamic time to be alive and launching your career. And so approach it, if you will, with zest, with optimism, with eager anticipation. Live it up. Have a ball. You will, and we will make of what lies before us better days. We will realize the opportunity and avoid the danger if we pay our bills. When I say pay our bills, I don't mean in the sense of paying the butcher or the baker or the candlestick maker. It's a good idea to keep him paid too, of course. But rather, I mean in terms of returning in kind for what you have gained, for the services, for the benefits from which you have profited. Here today, you conclude your career in this high school. You owe a lot of people a bill for it, your teachers, your parents, your community. You see, neither you or your family, and obviously I include myself in this, has paid our own way. The taxes that you and your parents paid less than half the cost of your education here. And as you go on to college, whether it be to a public or a private institution, the same thing will be true. If it costs you $2,500 a year and you write a check, that still will be only about half of the cost. And so you owe a bill here. And I would say in part it can be repaid by the support of education for others who will follow you, as your parents and some of us have sought to make it available, and as your community, your county, your state, and your nation has made it available. Because the thing that has characterized our nation, and I think the outstanding element in its success, has been education. This has been the input, as economists say again and again, which has made possible the tremendously increased output. So this is one bill that, looking to the future, you'll be called on to pay. And remember your profit from it, and pay in kind when your help and support for someone else is needed. Secondly, another bill we all owe is that of being born in this country, where we have more opportunity than any other nation in the history of the world. I define opportunity as the chance to make the best use and to develop the talents that each of us have to the maximum. And in this country of ours, more people than anywhere at any time in the history of man have an opportunity to do that. But everyone does not. We ought to keep in mind that our Constitution says this: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that doesn't mean that we all are the same kind of people, we all have equal talents or abilities, but it does mean that as Americans, we're entitled to equal opportunity to develop those talents, whatever they may be, regardless of our color, creed, religion, or place of national origin. That is not true for millions of Americans today, and we ought to take it to heart because we fall short of this great standard, which has made it possible for everyone in this nation to enjoy an opportunity better than anywhere else in history, despite the fact that obviously we fall short of that goal, and particularly where Negro Americans are concerned today. Witness the great national soul-searching that's underway, when we realize, as the President said when he spoke to the nation just a few days ago, that a Negro American boy or girl has only 50% as much chance, 50% as much, as you young men and women here to graduate from high school. Only one-third the chance to graduate from college. Only one-seventh the chance to ever earn as much as $10,000 a year. Twice the chance to be unemployed. I think these figures stand for themselves. As we follow our own individual paths, as we seek to develop our talents in this land of opportunity, let us recall that we have bills to pay for that opportunity that we enjoy in terms of making that opportunity available to all Americans. Finally, one other bill that comes in the field in which I follow my daily work, that of agriculture. We have just completed in Washington a World Food Congress. 1,330 delegates here from 104 nations all over the world. The focus of this World Food Congress was to bring to the attention of the world the fact that one-third of the world has more to eat than we know what to do with, and in the near future we'll have about twice as much as we can use ourselves. That's the so-called northern western part. In the near future, we will be able to produce twice the food and fiber that we are able to use. Isn't that a sensational thing and a tremendous accomplishment in this new world of ours? But yet two-thirds of the people of the world, a great many of two-thirds of the people of the world, which means 2 billion plus, are malnourished or undernourished. And we haven't quite been able to figure out how we can utilize the productive capacity in one part of this world so people need not go hungry in other parts of this world. And if you look at the last issue of Newsweek, you'll see some examples of what that can mean. Here we speak of paying our bills in an international sense, as we who are so blessed